What's good? What's good? I am back. One and only Paul Masson, live from Vietnam. You know how we do. Live Thursdays and Fridays, but I might be changing it up. I might be just going Fridays because we're going to start doing conspiracy theories here soon. So we're live on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. Every time I go live, audio version also go to Spotify, Apple, Amazon, Deezer, TuneIn, Stitcher, Slacker, iHeartRadio, Player FM, and much, much more. Got a guest coming on in a few. Gonna give him a little bit of time. He's on West Coast time. Go check out the last couple interviews I did. I did an interview with Bo Rock from the Dove Shack just recently. Check that out. We talked about summertime in the LBC and a bunch more. We also did an interview with Lord Zen from the Visionaries, and I'm working on interviewing a couple other cats from the Visionaries as well. Tomorrow we're supposed to have Chiron, a.k.a. Solo from Screwball, which one of my favorite groups was Screwball. Like, all their beats were dope as hell when they came out. So let me get on this email real quick. We got Johnny Dozier in the building. Dozier, you know you should come over to YouTube and stream in so your comments will show up on the thing. Let's see if Jam make sure he's still good. I know sometimes people have issues. Oh, here we go. All right, so our guest just popped up, and let me introduce him. Been DJing for well over 30 years, originally born in Maryland, grew up in San Diego, partly Dallas. And he's literally, he's also DJed in radio. He's did mixtapes. And he's pretty much been the official tour DJ for a guy who's probably the most beloved rapper of all time. And a guy who's probably the greatest producer of all time, in my opinion. Let's bring on the one and only DJ Jam. Jam, what's good, man? I can't hear you. Yeah, I can't hear him right now. Let's see.
One, two.
There you go. There you go.
All right. I got an external mic. I forgot.
Okay.
What's good, man? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. I mean, I don't know if you know, I've known you for a long time now, man.
Yeah. We go back a minute.
Yeah. It's been a while, man. What, you were just overseas recently. Wasn't you near like a war zone or something?
Yeah, man. Actually, it broke out while I was there. I guess since the beginning of April, I've been going back and forth from Thailand to Cambodia.
Okay.
So I went for the month of April, and I came home for like a week. And then actually Snoop Dogg's son saw that I was out there in Thailand and Cambodia in April. And so when I got home, I started posting pictures, and he saw it. And basically he wanted me to go out there with him the next following week for another month, because he just released a new project, and he wanted to go and link with like the DJs and artists over there to do some collaborations and stuff like that. And he didn't know anybody, so I've been going out there for years. So yeah, man, I went out there for a month, came home for a week, and went back up out there for another month and a half.
So you say you took Snoop's son out there?
Yeah.
So you like Uncle Jam. You like Uncle Jam.
Yeah. His oldest son, Spank, he just released a project. He's kind of like on a hippie era kind of vibe.
Okay.
And so he's got a lot of music with featuring live instrumentation. Like he can perform with a band. He has a band and everything. So he's not trying to be like his father. He's trying to be something different, you know? Yeah. So we're out there doing it. I connected him with all the players out there, went in the studio, did songs with a few of the artists out there in Cambodia and Thailand and Bangkok, and shot a few videos after they did the songs with the artists. Yeah. And yeah, I got it in with the DJ. So it was a good trip. Well, I ended up in Cambodia, and actually I just opened a beauty salon there. Just this past Monday. So Damn. When I was out there the first time, I wasn't out there trying to do business, but I was just out there and it just fell into my lap, a situation, yeah. and I jumped on it. So when I went back out there after I finished with Snoop's son, I flew back to Cambodia to the city where my salon is to finish getting everything ready and set to go, to open the doors, like ordering, buying all the stuff. So, So while I was out there, man, that's when kind of the war broke out. And at first it was just, you know, somebody shot somebody, like one of the guards or something at the border. And that's how it all started. So they were going back and forth for a while. But the day I actually left is when things escalated and they started shooting air missiles at each other. And actually a Thai F-16 fighter was shot down by Cambodia. And when I went to the airport, they dropped me off at the airport in Cambodia when I was coming home. I wasn't on social networks, really, and I didn't watch any TV while I was out there, you know, in Cambodia, yeah. North Thailand. You know, I was actually in with the culture. So I didn't know what was going on besides, you know, the people that were talking about, you know, the war, whatever, you know, things working out at the border. So when they dropped me off at the airport, there was nobody else, dude. Like, I thought I was in a scene from the Twilight Zone. Like, this, I've been traveling the world for years, dude. This never happened to me. They dropped me off at the airport, and there's nobody pulling up. Like, I'm the only car that pulled up to drop somebody off. There's nobody leaving the airport. There's nobody getting dropped off at the airport. It's just me, right? So I'm like, first of all, I'm like, well, that's weird, you know, but it was like 6 o'clock in the evening. So I was trying to make something of it. And I was like, well, maybe people don't really fly at this time because of work or something. You know what I mean? I was trying to think of anything to make sense. So they had they got security outside the airport. They check your passport or whatever before you actually walk in. So they check my passport. Doors open up. I walk in to the main floor lobby where all the ticket counters are. Yeah. Nobody. And I mean, nobody. I was the only person. Civilian walked in there and I looked and there's two ladies behind the ticket counter where I have to go get my ticket. And besides that, there were like five security guards on the floor in the lobby, but they were just standing there because there was nobody in there. Right. So they give me my ticket. They're like, yeah, walk that way to customs. Cool. I start walking and I get to customs. The dude asks for my passport. He waves me through and I turn and go through where all the like the booths are, where they take your picture and all that. You go through actual customs. Nobody, not one person, dude. And I was like, what? So I could walk right up, take my picture, give them my passport. They send me through. Then you go through the checkpoint to check your bag, you know, take your laptop out, send to the x-ray. I'm only person again going through that. I go through that. Now I'm walking to my gate. There's nobody buying food, nobody walking around, nothing, dude. I finally get to my gate and there's like eight people sitting there. You know what I mean? And they don't speak English. So I didn't have anybody to ask questions to. So I just sat down.
So you don't even know why it was like that?
No, I'm just sitting here trying to make sense of something. Maybe people don't fly at this time, really.
I'm thinking everybody done flown out already before the war and then nobody wanted to fly in. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, so, but I'm not thinking, I'm not knowing that the war escalated to air missiles, you know what I mean? This time, right? So, we're sitting there, and then, like, you know, I got there a little bit before the plane, so I had a little bit of time. So, as we're sitting there, like, four more people walked up, like, 15 minutes later. So, it was like, you know, 13 of us or something, right? And then all of a sudden, this propeller plane pulls up. And I've been back and forth from Thailand to Cambodia. It's always a regular airliner. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So this little propeller plane pulls up and I'm like, what? But I'm like thinking once again, I'm like, well, maybe they gave us a little plane because there's only 13 of us. Right. So I'm trying to make it make sense. So we get on the plane and all of a sudden the pilot's like, oh, we got a delay. We got like 20, 30 minute delay, flight delay. And at that point, I'm not paying attention because delays happen all the time. I'm used to it. Mm-hmm. By that time, I'm looking at my entertainment system trying to pick a movie, right? So only thing I hear is, oh, we're delayed 20, 30 minutes, whatever, right? So 30 minutes later, we take off, right? So I told my friend in Cambodia, hey, you know, of course, when I get home, I'm going to hit you and let you know I made it home safe, whatever, cool. So we take off, dude. My plane that I was on actually flew back into Thailand, to Bangkok, to the international airport where I could switch planes, then fly home, right?
Damn.
So we take off, we land in Bangkok, switch planes, whatever. I get home. It was really late at night. I message my friend. Hey, I made it home safe. Just want to let you know, right? Dude, they hit me right back immediately with links showing Cambodia and Thailand shooting missiles, and they shot a F-16 down. And my friend was like, we're at war now. So now it all makes sense. Nobody was at the airport because they were shooting missiles. Who's going to fly when they're shooting missiles in the air? You know what I mean? That's why the airport was empty. You know what I mean? And then that's why our flight was delayed 30 minutes, probably because they had to check the airspace and make sure that it was cool, right?
Yeah.
And good thing my flight was actually flying back into Thailand, to Bangkok. So they wouldn't have probably wanted to mess with that plane anyway, because they probably thought there could be some Thai people coming back home, right?
So
that was my last day.
And they did y'all like major, I don't know if you remember Major League One, where the owner made them fly on a little propeller plane.
Oh, right. Yeah, I was like, you know,
it was shaking like crazy.
And I've flown on those little propeller planes sometimes, because sometimes I DJ in certain countries and they have little islands, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you got, you know, like island hop, one of them being Hawaii. Hawaii, if you're flying between the little islands, it's usually a little prop plane. You know what I mean? So I was used to it, but I was just like, why all of a sudden do they give us a propeller plane when I always fly in a regular airliner back and forth? You know what I mean? So, yeah, dude, that was my last day episode.
So let's get into you some. It says you started DJing at 15, first gig at 16. What drew you towards DJing?
My brother-in-law's friend. My brother-in-law was in the military and living in San Diego. It's a big military town. And so he was stationed in San Diego, and he had a friend that was in the military also, but his friend had gotten out of the military. So he wasn't active at the time. Mm-hmm. And one summer, his friend flew out to San Diego to stay for the summer. Right. And his friend was a big DJ in New York and New Jersey. He was actually from New Jersey, right? Big club DJ back then. And so he came out, bought his two turntables, a mixer, and bought a couple crates of records, right? And he set it all up at my sister's apartment with my brother-in-law, set all his equipment up, and he would practice like every day, right? So I would ride my bike all the way across town, because I used to race bikes at the time. So I used to ride a lot to work out. And so I used to ride my bike across town every day just to sit there and watch him, you know, with those turntables practicing and whatever. And like during the summer, they gave a party for all the military friends. So I got to go. I was like the youngest one in there, but, you know, whatever. I got to see him do his thing at the party. And at the end of the summertime, it was time for him to go back home. And my brother-in-law saw how into it I was by riding my bike basically over there every day watching him. So my brother-in-law paid his friend for his equipment, because back then, like, everybody got, mostly all the DJs got their equipment from New York. You had to order it from New York or whatever, right? So my brother-in-law paid him for his two turntables and a mixer. And it was like, hey, just get you a new set when you get home, right? And his friend left me a whole crate of records and was like, here you go. Right? So, yeah, I took that, man, and the rest was history.
So I seen you did some radio. You worked for a few stations, 92.5, and it looks like KKB, TFM.
92.3 The Beat, as well as Power 106.
Okay.
Power 106 is the competitor. So I started on 92.3 The Beat, which was the newest station at the time.
Uh-huh.
And years later, I helped take that station to number one and beat out the competitor who had always been number one, which was Power 106.
Okay.
But soon after that, I left the station to join Snoop at the competitor's at the competitor station, because Snoop started a new show, Big Snoop Dogg Radio, over there.
Okay. And
at the station that I was at, you know, when I said we took that station to number one, before it was number one, before they fired the program director, right? The mm-hmm. day before the ratings came out, they let her go, right? So mm-hmm. I had an office at that time because I'm mix show and music coordinator. So they gave me an office and all that. So we always meet in the general manager's office at the fax machine and see the numbers, the ratings come out, right? So mm-hmm. I show up that day at work, I go in there and I'm like, yo, where's Michelle? That's her name. Where's the program director? Nobody's saying nothing, right? So we're sitting there waiting, and I had to grab something out of my office. So I run in my office and somebody comes in there and says, hey man, they fired Michelle yesterday. And Michelle was the person who put me on and, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Let me do what I do. So I couldn't understand, like, you know, our station was always getting momentum. We were getting closer to the competitor and they let her go. So I go back in the general manager's office and the ratings come out. When the ratings come out, we're number one, right?
Yeah.
When that happened, dude, they didn't even have the audacity to call the program director back. You know what I mean? To basically apologize and get the program director back. And the reason why they let her go was because they thought she was playing too much hip hop.
Okay.
You know what I mean? At the
what
time,
was this, early 90s?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. They thought she was playing too much hip hop. It was what, 95? No, this was later. This was 98. This was 1998. And the reason why I remember it was 1998 was because when they let her go, that showed me something in radio, like, wow, man, they're not really your friend. You know what I mean? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's a business. And, you know, if they let her go and she was kicking ass, like, you know what I mean? I had a different perspective about radio. So when that happened, they let her go. Snoop had left Def Row and Master P had just signed him, right?
Okay, yeah.
So we went up, and so at the end of 98, we went on No Limit, Snoop Dogg No Limit tour, right? When Snoop Dogg just went over there.
Yeah, yeah.
So the station used to always let me go on tour when I had to, you know what I mean? And when I got back, I have still got my position, right? I just come back to work. So this time, though, when we went on this tour, I went to him and I said, hey, I'm about to go on tour with Snoop, and I'm not coming back when we get back. And I told him that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, because I saw what she did, what they did to the PD. And Snoop told me, Snoop knew about it because I told him, and he was like, yo, Jam, when we get back off this tour, just come with me. I want you to produce and, you know, of course, be the DJ on my show that I started over there at Power, right? So I was like, cool. So not only did he bring me over there and I co-produced the show and everything that actually got picked up by a syndication company later, but I was actually, the station had me as one of the resident DJs also. So I was like one of the staff mixers at that time too. So yeah, so basically after that, so I went to the competitor, and then our show, me and Snoop's show, was picked up by a syndication company, right? So now every station had to pay for it. Power 106 didn't want to pay for it or didn't want to let them get their commercials. That's how the syndication companies make their money, right? They put commercials
on.
And Power 106 wouldn't let them do that. So they were like, well, shoot, we own the show now. So they shopped it back to the competitor where I used to be, and they accepted it. So then I went back to the station. So I'm the only station besides me and one other DJ now that just recently was at Power 106. We're the only two that started with one station, went to the competitor, and went back.
Well, let me ask you this. I always wondered this. What's the process of a DJ getting a job on radio? I mean, you don't just fill out an application, right?
No, it's usually because somebody at the station recognizes
okay
the talent, You know what I mean? Like, they should know, somebody there should know, like, who's the hot DJs in town, right? Who's the hot club DJs?
Club DJs. So basically come for you starting in a club typically and then get going to radio.
Yeah, I would say that most of the time that's how it works, because the station knows you're heavy in the club, yeah, and they're crowded. So that's what a better asset to have inside all these clubs, talking to the people, knowing that he's at your, on your station, you know?
So
at the time when I went to the beat though, in LA, I was on radio in San Diego at the station. But then when I went to LA, I connected with Snoop and Dre, and I was at the beginning when I just connected with them. And I was doing all the top clubs in LA. So they really found me then, you know what I mean? And because it was like, they were like, who is this new guy in town? And all of a sudden I was DJing all the premier clubs after I started with the first club that I started at. All the other promoters found out about me. So yeah, that's how I made that transition.
So I read where it says Corrupt and L-Dog, I guess, introduced you to Snoop. I'm not familiar with L-Dog, and how did you meet Corrupt?
Yeah, so L-Dog was one of Corrupt's best friends.
Okay.
And L-Dog was going to college in San Diego. I was doing all the big parties at San Diego State University, which was the number one party school at the time, right?
Okay.
I'll take part credit for that. But it was the number one college party school in the country at the time. And so L-Dog actually went to school there, but he was from LA. There was a lot of people from LA that went to San Diego State, right? So he came up to me at one of the parties that I did at San Diego State and was like, yo, man, I got a friend in LA who can rap. He's really good. I want to bring him down here to introduce you because I like what you do on these turntables, right? So I'm like, oh, okay, cool. So he told me this, man, like over and over again at different parties, to almost the fact that I thought he was just lying about it. You know what I mean? Like he was just talking to me. You know what I mean? So one weekend, I don't know if you're familiar with the step show, Greek step show events, where all the Greek fraternities come together.
Yeah.
They do like a contest, a stepping contest and all that. Well, so all the colleges from the LA area, surrounding areas come into town. Well, I do all the music for the whole weekend at San Diego State for that. So at the final event for the weekend is on Sunday is a picnic. Everybody comes before they leave back out of town. So I'm DJing at the picnic, and that dude L-Dog comes to the side of the stage because I'm up on a stage, and he's pointing at this dude, right, while I'm on stage. So I put my headphones down right to him. I'm like, what's up? He goes, this is that dude I was telling you about, Corrupt, right?
Okay.
And I look at him, I'm like, man, are you really Corrupt? I'm like, he's been telling me this for a long time, right? And he's like, yeah, I'm Corrupt. And like back then, dude, like at the parties, people really didn't want like MCs up there just rapping. They had to be dope.
Yeah. Or else yeah.
You know, we want to party, you know, get out of here type of thing, right?
Yeah.
But L-Dog had been pumping Corrupt up so hard, right? That I said, all right, I pulled him up on the stage and I gave him a microphone, right? And it was packed, dude. It was on the football field, right? It was packed. I was like, dude, you better be good. If not, they're going to boo you, right? Dude, I put on Hold On by En Vogue, the beginning, and I cut up that beginning. Corrupt must have freestyled, dude, for like 10 minutes straight. And the whole crowd, mouths were on the ground. They couldn't believe it.
Damn.
That was my
How old was he?
That was my introduction to Corrupt. I'm not sure actually how old he was. Young 20s, you know what
young
I mean?
And hungry. Young it and
wasn't,
hungry.
Ball Pound wasn't known at that time.
It okay. Corrupt
was in LA because he had done songs with the SOS band. You know the SOS band?
Yeah.
If you look on some of their albums, some of their last albums, Corrupt is on a song or two on the album.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, dude, little history for you. So he was spending time in LA, you know what I mean? And he did that in LA. And so he met everybody then, you know what I mean? Or I think he met Battling Snoop somewhere one day, you know what I mean? But so he wasn't really known at the time. He was still Corrupt. So how I met Snoop was I actually ended up transferring colleges from San Diego to Cal State Dominguez Hills in LA. mm-hmm. right? And when I did that, I lived on in an apartment on campus, and I bought up my equipment, my drum machine and everything. So I told Corrupt when I moved up there, I'm like, yo, I'm in LA now. You know what I mean? I got my drum machine, blah, blah, blah. I live on campus in the apartment, you know, come over. You know what I mean? He's like, because he asked me, oh, can I come write? You got some beats or instrumentals? You got your records? I could write. I'm like, yeah. So he used to come over and get dropped off at my apartment on campus. And I used to play him beats and instrumentals. He'd write to it. And then I would take him back home, right, in the evening time, right? So one day I went to take him back, and he was like, oh, drop me off, you know, at this other place. That's where everybody is at, right? And at that time, I was, you know, I was making mixtapes. So I was giving him my mixtapes, copies, right? And he would take them and play them when he was with Snoop and everybody, right? So then they were like, oh, damn, who's that? And they were like, oh, this is DJ Jam from San Diego, da 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 da. So when I dropped him off over where Snoop and everybody was, he was like, oh, come in so you can meet everybody. So I basically went in and everybody was there, like Daz and Nate and just like the whole crew, the homies and everything. And that's when I met Snoop, and they liked me for my DJing and doing tapes. And basically that's how that all happened, basically. And I started being down and riding, and, you know, and this is before music started being made, you know what I mean? So that's how I met Snoop. But I met Dre on a whole different account. You know, a lot of people think it was just one, but this is why I ended up DJing for both of them in all of Death Row. This is what made that happen. So when I told you I was DJing a lot of the big premier clubs in LA at the time, the biggest club that made all that happen, the first club I was doing, was a club called Jamaica House.
Okay.
At Jamaica House in LA, you can hit that history. That's the dude. That club's got probably some of the most history than any club in LA. So this club, Jamaica House, everybody came to. Famous actors and actresses, sports stars, rappers, singers, you know what I mean? They all came to this club. It was a who's who club. And all the big promoters who were doing the big clubs came to this club.
Okay. Also,
right? Every week they would have somebody perform, but they would never advertise on the flyer who it was. You had to show up, right?
Oh, shit.
I mean, everybody performed there, from Busta Rhymes and Tupac to Run DMC to Nas to everybody who was somebody. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you had to show up to know who was. So that was that club. So one
That's
night.
Crazy.
So one night I'm DJing this club. And the reason why I blew up so hard in LA is because when I started DJing this one club, the reason why they asked me to come to LA to do it was because they brought that club to San Diego, and it blew up the first night. And they bought a couple of their DJs from LA, from their Jamaica House LA down, but they wanted a San Diego DJ on the set as well. They didn't just want to come infiltrate San Diego, you know what I mean, with their DJs, and San Diego might not have liked that, right?
Yeah.
So they called the radio station and was like, hey, we're bringing this club. They got some commercials on the radio. They were like, hey, we want to add one of the DJs from San Diego to the roster. Who should we ask? And they're like, oh, you need to talk to Jam, right? So they hit me up and asked me to be one of the DJs. So I did something that no other DJ was doing. I started my set off with an Akai MPC 60. Uh-huh. I was the first one to have it in San Diego before they even came out. That's in a whole nother story. So I had this Akai MPC 60 because I saw a DJ, one of my mentors in San Diego, use a Roland 909 drum machine and incorporate it into his set, going from different beats that he programmed into mixing in different songs. You know what I mean? And
it'd
be dope. And I'm like, oh, shoot, that's sick. So when I saw this Akai MPC 60 before it came out and saw that you can sample and you can do beats on it, I was like, that's it. I'm going to sample the most popular songs that people know, you know what I mean? Bars, and measures of samples, and I'm going to program my beats on top of them. And then I'm going to mix the samples on top of each other, the ones around the same beats, BPMs, and I'm going to make dope sequences, and I'm going to use, like, little samples. Like, I have my little nephew say my name, DJ Jam, as a kid. DJ Jam. And I put DJ Jam. you know what I mean? In the pad. And I would hit that manually before people were talking about drumming, drum machine drumming and all that. You know, I was doing sequence and I was drumming with my name and without no records, right? This was just a drum machine rocking when I started my set. And the club, people in the club would come crowd around the DJ booth because they didn't know what the hell I was doing, but it sounded dope, right? So they would all crowd around, dude, and then I would have an acapella on each turntable, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Hip-hop acapella, R&B acapella, whatever. So I would rock these sequences for a minute, changing the sequences up of all these dope samples with my beats behind them, and then all of a sudden I would let it go, and I would cut in a verse from a rap verse or R&B verse over over the sequences that I'm rocking on the drum machine. And while the acapella was playing, I would switch up the sequences. You know what I mean? Man. And flip the sequences while. And then at the end of the verse, I would come with the other record and flip that and keep rocking the changes, the sequences. So I would do that. And then after all that, then I would go into the first record of my actual record of my set and mix that in and start going into records. And then halfway through my set, I would go back to the drum machine with a different BPM setting, you know, sequences, and I would go back to the drum machine and rock that for a second and then do the same thing over again. So I would do that at that club Jamaica House with all the stars there. So I blew up quick, instantly, with all the who's who artists, the record label people were there. So when they were seeing me do this, the record label people would come up to the DJ booth and be like, yo, Jam, can you do remixes? I sure can. Hadn't done no remixes at all, dude. I'm coming from San Diego. Yeah. I just messed up with the equipment, but I can't tell you I did any dope remixes, right? But I told them I could.
Yeah. Right?
So I started getting called to all the labels, dude, and started getting remix projects like that.
Yeah.
So Dre came up to that club one night. It was him and Suge and his group, Poor Broken Lonely. Shout out Chris the Glove Taylor. They all showed up, saw me rock and do my thing. Suge comes up to me after my set and invites me to go to dinner with all of them. Dre wants you to go to dinner, da 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 da. Right? I'm like, okay, cool. Right? Took my number. He called me. Showed up Century City at a strip club for dinner, eating steak and lobsters, watching strippers. Right? So Dre goes, and this is when Dre is laying low, like he had separated from Ruthless, and he hadn't done anything for a minute. Right?
Yeah.
He's like, yo, Jam, I'm about to start this project. I'm going to call it The Chronic. I need a DJ. Are you down? And I was going to college and everything, right? I wasn't even thinking about college. I was just like, what? I'm like, yeah, I'm down, right? So he gives me his number, and he's like, I give him mine, and he's like, okay, I'm gonna hit you when I start. Okay, cool. And, you know, I don't know if he was really going to call me. This is Dre, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was cool to hang with him when I thought that was cool anyway, regardless. So a few months later, he calls me and he's like, yo, Jam, I'll be at the studio. Meet me, you know, 7 o'clock, whatever, whatever. I'm like, oh, shoot. Okay. So I show up at the studio with my books from college. He doesn't even know I'm in college. You know what I mean? So I show up and I just put my bag on the couch and I'm at the board with him, you know, watching him do his thing, work. And then later on in the day, his friends would start coming down and show him up at the studio. So I would fall back on the couch and break out my books out of my book bag. So he saw me do that. He was like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm studying. Because I was going to college in LA to be an audio engineer. I was going to Cal State Dominguez Hills because they had recording studios on campus and had a recording music program. So he was like, what? You're doing what? And I told him, yeah. And so that was one of the ways I think I really got his respect, because he knew I wasn't just a DJ, you know what I mean? He was like, whoa, this dude is bigger than that, right? So I think he gave me a lot of respect and pulled me like a little in closer for that. So one day I'm sitting there with him at the board, right? All of a sudden, dude, the door opens in the studio and it's Snoop and the whole crew, right? And remember, the only thing I think Snoop had done with Dre at the time was Deep Cover, and that was a while
before,
right? So I wasn't even putting two to two together. So the door opens, Snoop, Dog Pound, Nate, everybody walks in, and I turn around and they see me sitting there with Dre, and they're like, what are you doing here? Right. and I'm not knowing the connection. So I look at them.
Yeah.
I've been coming, you know, with Dre, right? So yeah. I look at them like, what are you guys doing here? Right. And then Dre looks at both of us and is like, you guys know each other, right? And dude, the whole place just starts busting up, dude. And then they're like, they trip off of me because they're like, yo, wait a minute. You're a DJ from San Diego. How did you just infiltrate the whole camp like that? Both sides, you know what I mean? And it was that instance, dude, when that happened.
Yeah.
I think that solidified me as being the DJ for Death Row.
Nah, that's crazy. I mean, you knew crazy. Both of them. You knew both of them at the same time, but you didn't know. Why would you just know after one song that they was like?
Yeah, exactly. Like they were doing. Yeah. You know, they were close. Yeah. Like they were about to work on something else. You know what I mean?
So I saw something that was crazy. I don't know if this was true. You know, I did some, pulled up some ChatGPT info, but I saw where it said that you discovered Bow Wow.
Yeah.
So you discovered Bow Wow.
Yeah, in Columbus, Ohio.
Like at a show?
Yep.
And then what, you basically...
Adam Rapp, uh-huh. You know, people there, I think he was there with his mother, father, whatever, they got him in and bought him on stage because his family, mother, whatever, waved and flagged me, whatever.
Uh-huh.
We got him on stage and had him rap. I had him rap. He did a rap, dude. And I was just like, whoa, like this kid is crazy.
Yeah.
So I took him backstage. And this was early. Like I was warming up, making sure my equipment was cool, all that kind of stuff. Everybody's in the dressing room. So I take mm-hmm. him back in the dressing room and introduced him. And I got all this on video, dude, because I had a camcorder. I was the only one in our crew with a camcorder. People didn't have camcorders back then.
Back then,
the reason why I had a camcorder because DJs, most DJs are gadget guys. We love electronic gadgets, right? Yeah. So I had a camcorder just because I like gadgets. Didn't know what I was doing, you know what I mean? But I had a camcorder, and I would always film. Like Snoop and the whole crew would always clown me and make fun of me, you know, in fun. But you know, they every time they see me with the camera out, they'd be like, man. Why you always got the camera out, you know what I mean, and recording everything, right? So I recorded me taking little Bow Wow back in the dressing room, introducing him to everybody. Yeah. Dre has the boombox playing music, and I introduce him to everybody, and the first thing he does is breaks out a dance routine. He starts dancing. Shit. Yeah, like dancing really good, right? So everybody's like, whoa, this kid is dope, right? So then he stops dancing and we stop the music and he's like, they're like, oh yeah, he can rap. Let him do a rap. So we turn off the music, dude, and he rapped right there in the spot and blew everybody away. Basically, Dre told his parents to go home and pack a bag and meet back at the arena because we're taking them on the road with us. So after that happened, he rode city to city on the tour bus. And we would bring him out on stage in the middle, halfway through our show every night. And every night we did that, and he would rap, the whole crowd went crazy. And that's how the Little Bow Wow story started. After the tour was over, we flew Little Bow Wow out to live in L.A., put him in an apartment or a hotel or whatever, and that's when we were working on Doggy Style. And that's when so he was just in there. We had him in the studio just so he can take everything in, how the studio works and all that, right? So that's when he made his first appearance in the booth on Doggy Style. Remember the little kid, the skit? What do you want to be when you grow up?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, that's Bow Wow.
Okay.
So we did Doggy Style. After Doggy Style, that's when Dre broke and left Death Row. So little Bow Wow was just in L.A. with nothing to do, right?
Because
no studio was going on, nothing. So we remember when we were on that tour, one of the cities we hit was Atlanta.
Uh-huh.
Jermaine Dupri came out to the show with Eric Sermon backstage, and they met Little Bow Wow, right?
Yeah.
So when that happened in L.A. and Dre left, we contacted, well, not we, but they contacted Jermaine because they knew he was good with young groups, with kids.
Yeah, Crisscross and stuff. Yeah.
So And we knew that Jermaine saw him and really liked him, right? So, yeah, they contacted Jermaine, was like, yo, we got this kid, he's just sitting here. You know what I mean? You want to do something with him. And the rest was history.
So, basically, because he was on, I'm guessing because of that Doggy Style skit is why people kind of made it seem like Snoop brought him out and discovered him. Because that was always the rumor that Snoop discovered him.
Yeah, I mean, even after the discovery, because it was with the camp and Snoop co-signed him.
Yeah, yeah.
On his video, you know what I mean? Yeah. Snoop, that was the first video Snoop co-signed him. So they thought, okay, oh, that's Snoop's artist, you know what I mean? Probably artist or whatever. So that's what they were thinking. But Snoop even made it, told everybody when we did BET one day, Snoop interviewed him. We performed, and of course they interviewed him on BET. And that was one of the first things they asked him. They were like, yo, so you discovered Little Bow Wow? And he's like, nah, I didn't discover him. Actually, my DJ Jam discovered him. So that's when people were like, oh, shoot, okay.
So I seen where you worked with, you collaborated with a bunch of brands on like developing DJ equipment and software. What all did that entail?
Yeah, well, I work with different companies always.
Yeah, there's a bunch, yeah.
Yeah, and so I would always basically, you know, once I get equipment, I always like to analyze it and analyze, you know, what's not good or what could be better about it and things like that. So I would always reach out to these companies after getting their equipment, you know, because I was like, well, dang, if they could just do this with it, I would get it, you know what I mean, and use it, and it would help me, you know what I mean, be even better, whatever. So that's kind of how what I started doing, and then these companies started sending me their equipment. When they come out with a new whatever, they would
test it out
and be like, yo, Jim, give us some feedback, right? And then that turned into me getting deals, actually, you know, with companies. Like I got my own deal with a company called Aerial 7, who made headphones. So I developed two pair that actually came out of headphones, that actually came out to the market, which were two of the biggest sellers at the company. Regular DJ headphones, and then I created some in-ears also, but they sold the company before they came out. So yeah, so I've done all that type of stuff with companies.
I also seen something, let me pull it up, where is it at? Founded a Community Hands Network Foundation, what is it called? Community Hands Network Foundation, which includes Multimedia Mentor Academy and Animal Habitat and Pet Zoo. Are you still got that going on?
Yeah, the DJ side, we never got into the animal side. I mean, I bring kids over and introduce them to the animals. But as far as working with schools or whatever, it's the DJ side where I teach kids about the art of DJing and radio station operations. Like we take kids to the radio station and take them to the different departments so they learn how a radio station is run, and you know what I mean, what it all takes to do a radio station, and take them to a recording studio so they can see what goes on as far as music creation. Then take them to a retail outlet where they sell equipment so they can see the retail side of things. So just trying to enlighten them in the whole thing about music. They don't have to actually just try to be a DJ, but you know, music period.
Also saying, is it true that they call you the official DJ of the West? Who gave you that name?
Actually, it was a fan in Australia, like years ago. I was out there with Snoop, and I when we do a show, I'm usually the first person to the stage type of thing, you know, while they're still backstage. Mm-hmm. And I remember coming out to the stage, and there was a fan in the front, and he was just like, yo, that's the official DJ of the West. Right. And so he caught my attention, and I'm like, yo, I was like, oh, that's dope. He's like, yeah, you're the official DJ of the West because you DJ for all the best in the West, from Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre and the East Siders and Doggies Angels and 213 Crew, and just named in the Dog Pound and just named them. And I'm like, oh, wow, I got to keep that. So, yeah, that's how I got that name.
Now, I had a guest on last week I interviewed. I was just curious, did y'all cross paths? Because I think y'all probably did. Bo Rock from the Dub Shack? Yeah. The Dub Shack? Yeah.
Of course. That's family.
Yeah, because he's tied in with Warren G, so.
Yeah, and I DJ for Warren.
Yeah. Are you DJ for Warren, too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Yep. Tour with Warren. That's all family.
Let me ask you this. So you've DJ for Dre when it's just Dre's tour, right? And then DJ with Snoop on just his tours.
Mm-hmm.
Dre being the perfectionist he is he more like demanding? Oh man, I just lost my camera.
There you go.
Yeah. Is Dre like he's a perfectionist? Is he more demanding on his tours? Like
at first, he was before Snoop because Snoop didn't really know what it takes to do, you know, to put together a show.
Yeah.
So the discipline came from Dre.
Okay.
Dre is a perfectionist. That's why
he is.
He doesn't care what the label record label says about a due date. Dre is like, I don't care about your due date. It's going to be done when I say it's done. Right.
Yeah.
So when it came time to do the Up and Smoke tour, for instance, like from beginning to end of that show, there's something going on and it's all time. You know what I mean? Timing. It's got a boom, boom, boom. And I orchestrated all the sound that came out of those speakers besides the microphones.
Yeah.
That means so the turntables and me cutting, the instant replays and the mini discs, dual mini disc players.
Yeah.
Controlling, and with all the effects.
Yeah.
Right? I'm doing all that on cue, song by song. You know what I mean? Like up here doing all this and cutting at the same time and actually pulled that off. You know what I mean? I'm not like bragging or whatever, but I'm just letting you know, like, and because other DJs asked me about this, because in the Up and Smoke DVD, I guess at some points you can see kind of my equipment in the back. And it's not just two turntables and an instant replay. It's like I got a lot. And then when we did the song with Devin the Dude, I Just Want to Fuck You, there's a guitar song. There's a guitar solo, right?
Yeah.
So they throw me a wireless guitar. If you watch the Up and Smoke Tour DVD, they throw me the wireless. And I start playing for the intro when Devin walks out. So that's like what it takes to do that type of show from beginning to end. But Snoop later on, after he did shows, he got like that too, where he's like, oh, okay, now if you see a Snoop show, it's from beginning to end, basically.
Okay.
Something going on. He's a perfectionist now with what he does because he knows that's where he came from, you know?
Well, so you've been there basically since the beginning of the Snoop and Dre situation, pretty much, right?
Yeah, so, before the beginning of Death Row.
Were you around though? Were you still like close to Dre when he went to Aftermath and discovered him?
Yeah, that was kind of like at the beginning. You know, that was after the Chronic and before around Doggy Style.
Okay. Now, when he first got M, did everybody see what the vision? I mean, because Dre, like they said, Dre basically bet the whole farm on Eminem. Like, because he, you know, he kept leaving situations where he was getting screwed over. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And they say he put really much all on the line for the Eminem situation.
Yeah, because it was a different thing, you know, because Eminem was white.
Yeah.
Right. So Dre was like, well, shoot, dang, how are we gonna do this? Is this gonna work? Whatever, whatever. So that was the whole mystery. But as far as Eminem being dope, like he was already certified because he was you know, the show The Wake Up Show with Sway and King Tech.
Yeah.
That's how they found out about him.
Okay.
So he was already Wake Up Show tested. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, and M was already on that pedestal when Dre heard him on the Wake Up Show. So they knew what he could do. He was just like, yo, how are we going to do this type of thing?
Does Dre literally got the best ear in hip-hop? I mean, because he's had his hands on some of the biggest albums ever.
Yeah.
With the NWA album, the Chronic, the Chronic 2001, the Snoop Dogg's first album, Eminem's album, 50 Cent's, I guess you say first two albums, second and third album, because technically the other one was the first. And then you got Kendrick too, man. I mean.
Yep. Dre's got that ear. And if you study Dre's artists that he's basically bought out and blown up, uh-huh. you'll notice one thing in common.
What's
that? Are you
familiar
with that one thing?
I almost want to say that they're perfectionists like him.
Okay.
Like Kendrick seems to be a perfectionist.
Yeah.
Like he's just like Dre.
There's one thing that really sticks out.
What's that?
They all have in common. And this is the main ingredient, other than them just being dope.
Uh-huh.
The main ingredient of what Dre looks for in an artist, and this is coming from me.
Okay.
Is the vocality of that artist, the voice.
Okay.
Listen, look at all the ones who have blown up and think about how their voices sound.
Snoop is definitely a guy who the voice.
He's done that since Eazy-E.
Yeah. Eazy the voice. No, you're right. And he,
like every one of
he
his
made artists, Eazy-E a rapper. Oh,
yeah.
Man.
Any one of his artists can do a song without you knowing it was them and you know it's them immediately.
Yo, get off my cord. Damn, dog, not unplugging my cord. Yo, get off my cord. Well, go ahead. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, any of his artists, though, like, have a distinct voice big time.
Get off my cord, man. Damn. Man, I'm about to whip her tail.
Did he eat your cord?
All right, there we go. Sorry about that, man. She over there, my dog over there, kept unplugging my cord. But yeah, man, that makes sense. I mean, Eminem, when he first came out, the voice was totally different. I'm not even really big on his stuff nowadays, to be honest with you.
Yeah, but just the fact that all of them have a very distinct, different type of voice. 50 Cent.
Like yeah.
All of them, voices are to the left or to the right.
We about to hit the hour mark, man. Before we go, like, what can we expect in the future from you?
Man, radio.
Okay.
Working, you know, I have two shows that are syndicated. I'm actually on a break right now because I'm about to move to Thailand and Cambodia.
Okay.
At the beginning of November. So I'm on a actually administrative leave kind of from radio. So I'll be going back to radio when I get everything set up out there. Mm-hmm. And actually working on my own radio project, which I'll bring to light later. And then as well as I'm about to get back into production, I'll be working with a lot of artists from a lot of Thai and Cambodia, artists from Cambodia, as well as China, and kind of bridging the gap, doing songs for them, but then also doing some songs featuring artists from the States as well. So trying to bring those two together.
That's what's up, man. I appreciate you taking time out, man. I know there's probably a lot more we could cover, man. Like, you got a lot to talk about, man.
Yeah, well, I'm sure. Just let me know and we can do it again sometime.
That's what's up, man. I know. I heard it's like 105 degrees out there y'all's way today.
Yes, it is. Very, very hot while I'm inside.
Well, like I said, appreciate you, man. Like, we've known each other for at least, I think, about a decade, man.
Yep,
I know we talked on the phone a couple times back in the days.
Yep, yep. So yeah, man, you know, appreciate you, man. Once yep. again, you've been doing your thing for years, man. Keep doing
appreciate it.
Keep doing what you do, because I see what you're doing. And yeah, man, let's talk again soon.
All right, man. Enjoy the rest of your day.
All right, you too.
All right, peace. Oh man, my dog done. She done got me on the green screen right now. I can't even get my screen to pop up now. Thank you, Gia. Well, appreciate y'all tuning in, man. That was DJ Jam. Crazy story. I mean, like, the dude literally met Corrupt, you know, met Snoop, met Dre, didn't know that all these guys really knew each other, and then end up being at Dre's, and then they all walk in at the same time, and what do you know? Small world. Small world. Internet definitely made things a small world. Shouts out to my man, Mr. Myrtle Beach. You say he got his from the barbershop. Yeah, I'm still green, man. Like she literally unplugged me like two or three times. And now I can't even get that screen to go back. It's all good. It's all good. Great stories. I mean, this guy literally is DJed for Snoop Dogg, who I said is probably the most beloved hip hop artist of all time, and literally DJed for Dr. Dre. I mean, he did the Up and Smoke tour, the Chronic tours. What other tours did I see? How the West Was Won tour, Good Vibes tour, and Up and Smoke tour, that was legendary. Chronic. That was a crazy time. You know, yeah, man, it's definitely got to be a blessing to be able to be around a mind like Dr. Dre, who's a perfectionist, who changed the standards of Sonics and the music business altogether. When he dropped the Chronic album, it was probably the best quality recorded album of all time up to that point. You know, because Dr. Dre's just, he's turning knobs and turning knobs and turning knobs. Before we go, though, I saw where people are making a big deal out of this Fivio Foreign cat. I don't know if it's true, but he said something. They had a post saying that he was saying that... I don't know if he was saying Nas, what he wasn't necessarily legendary, but he couldn't like recite one of his bars or remember one of his bars. I'm really starting to think that the people that put these posts out is totally to try to stir the pot, to try to stir up some controversy, to make a cat like Nas like react and reply and even entertain this BS. Like, y'all definitely like to try to divide and conquer. Y'all definitely try to stir shit up. I don't think Nas give a rat's ass if Fivio Foreign or whatever his name is can recite one of his lyrics. I can tell you Nas got way more classic lines than this cat. In 5 years from now, or less, people are going to be saying the same thing about this guy. I mean, can anybody even recite one of his lines? You know, I doubt it. And don't be talking about, like, these new day rappers, don't be talking about nobody can recite your bars when y'all dudes don't even spit bars, man. Y'all ain't even spitting bars. Ain't none of y'all got nothing that we got. I would rewind, like, oh my gosh, did you hear what he said? Rewind that. Let's hear that again. Nah, man. I don't know why Nas would entertain it. I don't know why any real hip-hop fan would entertain it. It's kind of like when Jada was talking about Will.i.am, you know, comparing Black Thought, saying he's a trillion times better than Jay-Z. Like I said, the masses wouldn't say that. Maybe some underground hip-hop heads or hip-hop purists might would say that, but the masses would not say that because Jay-Z's been far more successful. And part of that is, like, you know, like, a cat like Jay-Z, you know, might feel the need to retire as reply as competitive as he is, you know what I'm saying? But this is like a divide and conquer thing. Nobody cares what Fivio Foreign or whatever his name is talking about, who, what bars he can recite when this guy ain't spit no bars. 5 years from now, ain't nobody even gonna remember a song he put out. You know, I think what these cats don't realize nowadays is none of they shit stands out, because they all just rapping over the same exact sounding kind of beats. They all rapping the same exact kind of styles. They all, a lot of them are too much auto-tune, you know. Like, if everybody's auto-tuning, nobody's standing out. Everybody's rapping over the same beats, nobody's standing out. Something I was talking about earlier today is, like, if you look at the 80s, 80s had its sound, but it lasted just the 80s, 10 years. Then 90s started coming in, and the sound started changing. And then you got that 90s sound. But it only lasted, like, 10 years. You know, by the time you hit 2000s, 90s sound was somewhat fading out. It was still, I guess you could say, a New York hip-hop traditional sound going on up north. But I think once New York decided that we're going to do away from the traditional New York sound altogether, and we're going to go and just do trap and drill, or we're going to try to mimic the South and copy the South, that's when things really, really changed. Because New York has always been a staple of being a trendsetter of people copying and mimicking New York and trying to be like New York. Because at first, that it was really only New York hip hop until artists started coming out and, you know, Philly, Boston, Jersey, and all these other states and West Coast. And everybody at first was getting all their influence from New York. So New York has always been, you know, influential in the music business of hip hop and just the music business in general. So once they start trying to copy the South and mimic the South and can't even do it right, that's when things start really changing. And now you got everybody sounding like everybody. Nobody's regional no more except the West Coast. The West Coast is really the only place with a regional sound. Maybe if the Texas artists would come out today, but there's not a lot of mainstream Texas. Actually, you know what? The Texas artists nowadays don't sound regional either, because they sound just like everything else. So nothing is regional anymore except the West Coast. New York changed their sound. Everybody's copying, you know, the South or what they thought was the South or sounds like the South. We pretty much set the tone for a while. And then you had like Chicago and everybody else trying to sound like us. And that's the thing. The sound they created necessarily wasn't the Southern sound. It was a Fugazi version. It was a let's try to copycat and mimic, but we really can't do it. Because the problem is y'all can't be the South because y'all didn't have the South slang. Y'all didn't have the Southern slang. Y'all didn't have the Southern accents. None of that going on. You know what I'm saying? And now everybody sounds the same. All right, we about to wrap it up, man. Thank you, Gia, for literally unplugging my camera like 3 or 4 times. No treats for you. And making it where I can't even get the green screen to change right now, man. That's crazy, man. Like, what's going on? All right, so about to get off here, about to clip up some clips. Shouts out to DJ Jam. And as you hear, he say about to move to Cambodia, Thailand, just open up the salon out there. Congratulations to him. More power to him. Definitely going to keep supporting what he does. Known him for at least a decade. So it's been long overdue for me to get him on here. Go check out the interview I did with Bo Rock from the Dub Shack. Go check out the interview I did with Lord Zen and the Visionaries. So I've been on a West Coast run lately. Tomorrow we about to take it back to the East Coast. We're going up north, back into New York, Queensbridge, and we're going to, I think, Queensbridge. Yeah, Screwballs, Queensbridge, if I'm not mistaken. So we about to have Chiron, aka Solo. as soon as I get off here, I'm follow up with him, make sure we still good for the interview tomorrow. Also, go follow the Paul Pickett Podcast, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, Rumble, BitChute, all that good stuff. Audio version goes to Spotify, Apple, Amazon, Deezer, TuneIn, Stitcher, Slacker, iHeartRadio, Player FM, and much, much more. Also, we'll get back to doing music reviews. Haven't done music reviews for the last couple of weeks. And I'm going to start a conspiracy theory segment as well. So I'll probably stop doing interviews on Thursday. That way I could donate a day to conspiracy theories as well. So we're going to be doing music reviews, live interviews for musicians, hip-hop artists, and the bare knuckle interviews on Paul Pickett Podcast as well. And we're going to bring in a conspiracy theories segment, which I think I'm going to do conspiracy theories on the Paul Pickett Podcast, not necessarily on Live for Vietnam. Also, make sure y'all go check out Dizzle. If you don't Dizzle, go to DizzleBrand.com. Premium luxury liqueur mixed with agave tequila cognac, orange liquor, mango mix. Though you Dizzle on ice, and it's nice. Want to order your very own bottle or bottles, go to DizzleBrand.com. All right, we about to wrap it up. We hour 10 into it. Appreciate y'all tuning in. And apologize for my dog unplugging my camera a few times and making it where I'm stuck on a green screen right now. Peace, and I'm out.